let's just take that image of connecting to the infinite ground of all being, to a higher power in wilderness, in nature. Let us open ourselves in these moments right now. Open ourselves to the presence. Open ourselves to that which is eternal, that which is truth, that which is uncorruptible in this broken world. Father, mother, sister, brother, all my relations, God, I open my heart to you. I open myself to your presence and your guidance. Let us just take some moments with no narrative voice to feel that connective tissue of the universe enveloping us, helping us to re-remember who we really are. Let us just take these next few moments together to do our traditional Unity of Whidbey prayer circle, prayer open mic. It's great to be back every single month. And here we are in summer. All right, what's your summer story? Is it going to include the day that it was all overcast and then it didn't rain at the picnic?
Sounds hopeful.
Right? We love stories. We live by stories. Why do we use stories to make sense of our lives? Why did Jesus teach in parables? I think it's all simply because that's how we're wired. Narratives are how we comprehend our experience. If you were to ask me on a January day how my Christmas went, it wouldn't make much sense for me to show you a spreadsheet that displayed everything I spent on people in my life versus what I received. That would be one way for me to comprehend. But if you asked, and I do have that spreadsheet, by the way. I just don't share that. But if you ask that question, what you would want is the story of Christmas. What we did, who came visiting, how children's faces lit up, how the cat climbed up the Christmas tree and the dog barked, and all of that. Jesus was teaching in parables so his listeners would each have their own experience and own connection to the lesson. So stories. I have some stories to share, and I want to begin with the story of a woman named Roz Savage. Roz Savage. Rosalind Elizabeth Adriana Savage, Do you think her mother called her that when she was in trouble? Is an English woman, Oxford educated, who was working as a management consultant when at age 33 she thought to herself, I feel like I've got a purpose in life. And I'm not sure what it is, but I'm pretty sure this is not it. Have you ever had that moment? She has said in interviews that she was making a good living. She had a little red sports car, a lovely suburban home, and a tall, handsome husband. As she said, just like all my friends. She writes, in theory, I should have been happy. But she felt she was wasting the precious moments of time allotted to her. Her life force ebbing away with each irreplaceable tick of the clock. So she sat down one day and drafted two versions of her own obituary. The one that would be the end result of the life she was then living, and the one that she wanted, which would, she imagined, be a life of adventure. Having done this exercise, Miss Savage said, clearly something was going to have to change. She writes, little by little, I began to realign my life, to put myself on track for the obituary I really wanted. This is not the way we usually think of a life we're dreaming about, is it? But the obituary idea gives us a certain gravitas to the exercise. She says, I stopped caring so much about what other people thought of me and started caring more about what I thought of myself. I accepted that mistakes are a fact of life, an inevitable consequence of being adventurous and trying new things. I realized it matters less whether something is a success or a failure, and matters more what I learn from experience. Yeah, her life began to evolve, and she left her marriage and her comfortable home behind and experimented with new ways to live. She tried several different things, being a potter and being a swim teacher, different things. Well, I just made that up, but she tried different things. I think she did say being a potter in an interview. Ultimately, though, she says, and I quote, through a bit of a leap of logic, I decided to row across the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow. That's quite a leap.
Of course. By the way, she says that at this point, she had no ocean experience. And apart from having learned how to row in college, she had, as she put it, no other relevant skills whatsoever. And she points out she didn't really pick a good year to start rowing across oceans. 2005, when she crossed the Atlantic, was the year of Hurricane Katrina, and turns out to have been the year up to that point with the most hurricanes ever recorded in the Atlantic. Before she was halfway across, she recounts, all four of her oars had broken. Now, she had four oars. I don't think she's built like a Hindu goddess and was rowing four oars at the same time. I believe it was two spares, right? They had all broken. And she says, I'd never been very good at fixing stuff. But when you're in the middle of the ocean in a rowboat, fixing a broken oar is the only way to get to the other side. So with other parts from her boat, and of course with, you'll think of this as soon as I start, you can say it with me, duct tape. She made sufficient repairs to complete her journey. Roz Savage is now in the Guinness Book of World Records as the only woman who has rowed solo across the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Oceans in a 23-foot rowboat. Tasks that have taken her a cumulative 500 days, transiting 15,000 ocean miles with approximately 15 million oar strokes. If you do the math, that's 1,000 oar strokes per mile, which seems more impressive than your smartphone or Fitbit counting steps for you, doesn't it? She's received a Member of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire Award, is a Fellow of the Royal Society, just like me, is listed in the top 10 ultimate adventurers by National Geographic and so forth. Perhaps most importantly, her story about herself, authored by herself, underwent a profound shift from urban corporate creature, cubicle dweller, right, to adventurer of great renown who faced fear and pushed past it. Or perhaps she faced the dread of living an unremarkable life she felt indifferent to, and deadened by and pushed herself toward a life of purpose. This sense of agency she found has led her in her most recent chapter to stand for Parliament. And she's now the Liberal Democrat MP for the South Cotswolds, elected to office in July of 2024. Her website has this statement: "I believe that if you don't keep pushing the boundaries, keep expanding your comfort zone, your comfort zone actually gets smaller and smaller until you're shrink-wrapped in such a tiny comfort zone that you can't move. You can't achieve anything, you can't grow. And so I keep pushing, keep developing, keep growing. I keep showing what an ordinary person can do when they put their heart and mind and soul into it." What story are we telling ourselves about this chapter in our lives? What beliefs, perhaps self-limiting, do we hold about our own capacities? What restrictions do we put on ourselves to stay in our comfort zones? What tales do we each spin to make sense of our lives? Unity's third principle is we are co-creators with God, framing reality through thoughts held in mind. It is truly up to each of us to write our own life stories. It makes me think of a quote from RFK, the original RFK, not the one that bothers us in the news now. "Some see things as they are and ask why. I dream things that never were and ask why not. Why not?" Some of the people who dream things that never were are psychologists like Ellen Langer. And I want to tell you about Dr. Langer. In 1981, she became the first person, excuse me, the first woman to be tenured in psychology at a little place called Harvard. And I imagine that was based in no small part on a groundbreaking study she'd done a couple years prior. Langer gathered a group of men in their 80s who agreed to spend a week together in an environment she created, at an old, unused monastery in New Hampshire. For 1 week in 1979, Langer reproduced the year 1959. All the furnishings, calendars, newspapers, magazines, etc., were from 1959 and earlier. The temporary residents for that week could listen on the radio to Perry Como and Frank Sinatra, or tune their TVs to the Ed Sullivan Show, or Milton Berle, or Dobie Gillis. They were, in effect, residing in an earlier time, one they'd lived through at a younger point in their lives, and were encouraged to discuss the issues of 1959 as if they were current events. From the beginning of the week, participants were challenged to no longer see themselves as the old, well, let's just say older, men they had become. You're welcome. In fact, I'm right behind you. Their first test was to carry their own bulky suitcases into the building, for aside from the petite professor, 5'3", there were no staff available to help. And the building lacked mirrors, so participants weren't casting a critical eye at themselves. What happened after a week? First, I want to tell you that when Dr. Langer met some of the participants shuffling toward her office, often in the care of a daughter, she had second thoughts about what she was doing. She says she wondered if some of these men would make it to the end of the day, let alone go through a week in a new environment. But before the experiment, the men took a set of cognitive and physical tests. And these tests were then administered following the week in New Hampshire. After just 1 week, test results changed dramatically. The participants were stronger and more flexible. Height, weight, gait, posture, hearing, vision, and performance on intelligence tests had all improved. Men's joints were more flexible. Their shoulders were wider. By the way, this only works for men, not women, just saying. Ha ha. I just thought it would be a good time to make that joke. This test was done with men, but clearly it would, I think, apply to whatever gender we are. Their joints were more flexible, their shoulders wider, their fingers more agile, longer, and less gnarled by arthritis. All this was measured. Right? Study participants had been put in a context where association and imagination suggested they were younger, and the result was they seemed to have bodies and brains that actually were younger. In fact, as the guys were preparing to leave, one of them picked up a football and a spontaneous game of touch broke out, with more than one participant tossing aside a cane they'd previously believed they required. Wow. Photos were taken of each study participant before and after the week in New Hampshire. And then people were assigned to review the photos, people who knew nothing about the study. And invariably, they picked the after photos as having been taken of each man when they were younger. Ellen Langer, in discussing this groundbreaking study, says, "It is not our physical state that limits us." She holds that it's our mindset about our own limits, our perceptions of who we are, and our preconceptions about age that have perhaps the greatest effect on our daily lives. Maybe our imaginations have not been challenged by fresh perceptions or stretched to new dimensions, so we remember how bent over Aunt Sadie was at 78. And how forgetful Uncle Percy was at 82. And we think, well, that's it. The jig is up. That's how it is or will be for me at that age. We don't get beyond the comfort zone of sharing those beliefs about how we are and how we age with our family or with the stereotypes of our culture. A long time ago, our co-founder, Myrtle Fillmore, published her article titled How I Found Health in Unity Magazine. And I'm going to read some of what she wrote in 1897 in case you were subscribing then, but just don't remember every detail. She wrote, "I have made what seems to me a discovery. I was very sick. I had all the ills of mind and body that I could bear. Medicine and doctors had ceased to give me relief, and I was in despair until I affirmed my beliefs and I was healed. I did most of the healing myself because I wanted the understanding for future use." Myrtle found a source of healing within herself in her own ability to practice, and she used her own ability so she could have access to it from then on. What a freeing, positive statement about the power of mind and imagination. She writes, "This is how I made my discovery. It flashed upon me." She wrote that in 1897. Did you ever talk to somebody in the 60s or 70s and say, "Man, I just flashed on this idea"? You weren't the first. She said, "It flashed upon me that I might talk to the life in every part of my body and have it do what I wanted. I went to all the life centers in my body and spoke words of truth to them, words of strength and power. I asked their forgiveness for the foolish, ignorant course I had pursued in the past when I had condemned them and called them weak, inefficient, and diseased. I asked God to forgive me for taking divine life into my body and then using it so wastefully. I promised God I would never again retard the free flow of that life through my mind and my body through any false word or thought. I would bless and encourage it with true thoughts in the wise work of building up my body temple." Myrtle recovered from chronic tuberculosis and other health conditions and lived until 1931, to age 86. The power of thought and imagination, the practice of prayer and communion with spirit were all a part of how she rewrote her story. I do want to do a caveat here by mentioning that we do have medical approaches today that were not available to Myrtle in the 1890s. Things have advanced, and I would not want my words this morning to lead anyone to never consult with a healthcare professional when concerned about a condition. I work in healthcare. Come see us. I just want us to understand at a fundamental level that our experience of our age and limitations is conditioned to a great degree. We do co-create our reality through our thoughts and intentions and imaginations. I have one more tale to share with you. And this is of the remarkable Scottish mountaineer and writer, William Hutchison Murray, who lived from 1913 to 1986. His friends called him Bill, by the way, but I thought if I were to tell you I wanted to share something about Bill Murray, it could lead to confusion. On the first page of Murray's autobiography, and I think you'll love this title, "The Evidence of Things Not Seen, A Mountaineer's Tale," he writes, "I lacked a father, yet never felt shortchanged. He had been killed at Gallipoli in the Dardanelles campaign of 1915 when I was 2. I never knew him. The realization of loss came years later, but never did I feel wronged. How many of us feel wronged when a driver cuts us off on the freeway? Or, oh, I forget, we're on Whidbey Island. Rather than explain what a freeway is, let me just mention, let me reframe that one. How many of us feel wronged when someone takes a turn at a four-way stop sign that we think is our turn? There we go. You guys have stops. We have stop signs here, right? Yeah.
Don't talk about
radio. There you go. Murray lacked a father, but said, never did I feel wronged. Murray became an avid mountain climber in his teens and 20s, went on in his life to climb many peaks, author 20 books, and among the words he put on paper is a quote I'd like to share now. It fits the spirit of an adventurer like Murray or Roz Savage, who did not turn back even when the oars broke. It speaks to the character of an explorer of mind and body like Ellen Langer, or the soul of one who was truly committed to spiritual pursuits like Myrtle Fillmore. Murray wrote, "Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no one could have dreamed would have come their way. Whatever you can do or dream you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Begin it now." W.H. Murray. We may look at the brave adventures of Roz Savage, the mountain ascents of W.H. Murray, the spiritual wisdom of Myrtle Fillmore, or the psychological insights of Ellen Langer, with some sense that our efforts, our pathways are just pedestrian, ho-hum, commonplace, could never lead us to such notable achievements or remarkable discoveries. But a commitment to keeping ourselves open, to exploring new areas in our lives, reframing the stories we tell ourselves, is what we're invited to do again and again by Spirit. As Marianne Williamson tells us, there is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us. It's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give people permission to do the same. May we live in commitment to this spiritual truth, shunting aside thoughts and imaginings that limit us, to be more useful and loving expressions of the divine in this world. May our comfort zones, I'm comfortable with rain, ever expand, and our light perpetually shine. and may love spill from our hearts like rain falling from the sky, creating a force field of permission for that love to flow with all we meet.